From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. With 15 days before Election Day, President Trump is on the campaign trail in Arizona, where he's holding two rallies in two different cities. His opponent, Joe Biden, is meeting with advisors and preparing for the final presidential debate on Thursday. Let's get the latest from the 2020 campaign. NPR political correspondent Asma Khalid is here. And Asma, let's start with Trump's rally in Michigan on Saturday. He again went after Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, who's a Democrat who imposed pandemic restrictions in the state that Trump has criticized. And of course, it was recently discovered that she was the subject of an alleged kidnapping plot by a militia group. Trump said over the weekend that she should open up the state, open up the schools, and the crowd responded with this. Let's listen.
Lock her up,
they're saying. And here's Governor Whitmer responding yesterday on Meet the Press.
It's incredibly disturbing that the president of the United States, 10 days after a plot to kidnap, put me on trial and execute me, 10 days after that was uncovered, the president is at it again and inspiring and incentivizing and inciting this kind of domestic terrorism. It is wrong.
Asma, there's about 2 weeks left until the election. President Trump is behind in the polls, including in Michigan. Why is he still focusing on Gretchen Whitmer?
Well, Peter, I think it really comes down to this is where he feels most comfortable, right? I mean, the Trump campaign has struggled with a consistent message all throughout this reelection endeavor. And when we see what does President Trump love to do, he loves to resort to what is most comfortable and common for him. And that means, you know, sort of critiquing, attacking different female politicians, you know, relishing that sort of lock her up chant that we often heard, resorting to immigration language. I mean, these are all kind of a pullback to the classic greatest hits of the 2016 campaign. The challenge there for the president is that this is not the 2016 election cycle. He has been the incumbent now for a couple of years, and this election is largely seen by most analysts as being a referendum on how he's governed and most explicitly how he's handled the coronavirus pandemic.
Well, and to that point, he continues to undermine scientists and medical experts on the risk of the virus. And last night on 60 Minutes, Dr. Anthony Fauci said that he wasn't surprised that the president got sick, especially after the Rose Garden ceremony for Judge Amy Coney Barrett on September 26th. Of course, you remember this was a crowded event, no social distancing and very few masks.
When I saw that on TV, I said, oh, my goodness. Nothing good can come out of that. That's got to be a problem. And then sure enough, it turned out to be a super spreader event.
What do you make of this continued public disagreement between Dr. Fauci and President Trump?
So really, Peter, I think it speaks to the broader sort of difference of opinion between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. You know, we saw over the weekend, Trump mocked the fact that Biden, he says, will, quote, listen to the scientists. And he said at a rally that if he had listened to the scientists, the country would now be in a massive depression. And we've consistently heard Joe Biden point, you know, questions about the veracity of some of the claims that Donald Trump has made and the degree that he feels the president downplayed the coronavirus. So to me, you know, the conflict we've seen, I guess, to date between Dr. Fauci and the president is part of just a broader conflict that we've seen between the president and a various, you know, scientific advisors, the scientific community, and you could argue even just overall belief and trust in the scientific process around this pandemic. Mm.
Well, for his part, Joe Biden is still being cautious. He's not holding the kind of big rallies that Trump is having this week. And he's now spending time preparing for the last debate. What should we be looking forward to on Thursday after that first disastrous debate and then the second debate that was just canceled?
Well, as we know as of now, President Trump is not one to engage in traditional kind of boot camp debate prep. We have been told by a source familiar with the Biden campaign that part of his schedule today at least does involve debate prep. So there is clearly just a difference in how they're both approaching Thursday. Look, I think there's a lot on the line, more specifically, I would say, for Donald Trump, because he is down in the polls right now. And we're in a situation where millions of people have already begun voting. But, you know, can either one of them dramatically change the trajectory on one night? I would say that is the only night that either one of them has to dramatically change the trajectory of this race at this point. So a lot is on the line, but I would argue more is on the line for President Trump, given the fact that he does seem to be down in a number of polls, not just nationally, but in very key swing states that he needs.
That's NPR political correspondent Asma Khalid. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, right about now, many families are having tough conversations about Thanksgiving. Should they gather or not? COVID-19 is on the rise. And let's hear again from Dr. Anthony Fauci, this time in a CBS interview last week.
My Thanksgiving is going to look very different this year. I would love to have it with my children, but my children are in three separate states throughout the country. And in order for them to get here, they would all have to go to an airport, get on a plane, travel with public transportation. They themselves, because of their concern for me and my age, have decided they're not going to come home for Thanksgiving.
And earlier in the month, his colleague, Dr. Deborah Birx, warned that COVID-19 transmission is different than it was in the spring as people move indoors. That contact tracing data from Utah shows that 80% of their transmission is occurring between household members and gatherings. Let's bring Emory University's Dr. Carlos Del Rio in Atlanta. Dr. Del Rio, could you address why transmission between family members is rising? Dr. Birx talks about how with humidity dropping, it allows those respiratory droplets to stay in the air longer.
Well, Robin, I think inside the house, we're close to each other. We're not wearing a mask. We're basically sharing a common space, and that increases the risk of transmission. And we know from different studies that if you're infected and you go back into your household, about, 20% of the people living in that household are going to get infected. It may be a lot higher because it really depends on the kind of living conditions that you're in.
Yeah. Look, I'm looking at headlines. Here's one from the Chicago area, from the Chicago Tribune, that a teenager gave COVID-19 to 11 relatives across four states in a family vacation. It just seems so transmissible. And talk about another reason this might be happening. We know that if you're living with family members, you're pretty much safe with them. If you all know that you aren't sick, you're pretty much safe with the people that you're currently living with. But I've seen this firsthand. If you go to see other family members, you tend to forget. I mean, they're so familiar to you. It feels like they're part of your pod, but they're really not. You haven't been living with them.
Even family, I live with my wife, but she's working at the hospital, at one hospital. I'm working at another hospital. Yeah. She could potentially get infected. So even among ourselves, we try to, be sure that I tell people that early in the morning, I check myself to be sure I'm okay. But the most important thing, I smell my coffee. Now, if I can smell my coffee, that's my rapid test that I do every morning. And I think we all confront this, right, when we're trying to travel and visit family members and be with family members, that we think, well, this is my sister, and therefore she should be okay because she's my sister. But the reality is that she could have been infected. She could have a teenager that could bring the infection. So we see all this clusters of transmission occurring within families when people get together, when people gather. And that's when you start looking at the holidays and you really get very concerned because this could be a time that a lot of transmission can occur between Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, because people are going to be getting together with people that they feel comfortable with when the reality is there could be transmission happening.
Right. So what do you suggest? First of all, people who are thinking of flying to see someone, there's, cautions there. But what do you suggest about possibilities for getting together with people? Is it okay if it's outside? Can you share food?
Well, one of the things I would say is, first of all, flying, actually, we've learned from a variety of different studies that actually flying may be pretty safe. The planes are actually doing very well as far as, filtering the air, filtering particles. Many of the airlines are mandating masks, and people obviously need to wear them correctly. But I think the airlines are safe. What it may be a little more challenging is that trip to the airport, the taxi, the Uber, the walking around the airport, how crowded, security may be. That may be a little more challenging. So wearing a mask, wearing eye protection if you decide to travel is something that I always recommend, particularly during holiday season when there's going to be a lot of people traveling. Number two is I think it's okay to share food, but think about making a gathering that is smaller. In other words, have less than 10 people at the gathering. Make sure everybody at the gathering is healthy. Make sure that you have some social distancing when people are eating. So, no No, everybody hanging out together, not everybody, you know, hugging each other, but trying to keep some social distancing. If you can get people tested, I think that's useful. But again, remember, a test helps you identify who's infected, not necessarily who's not. So I'll give you my personal example. I plan to travel to visit my daughter, who's having a baby right around the time of Thanksgiving. So I plan to go up to see her, and I will probably get me and my wife will get COVID tested about 24 to 48 hours before we travel. And then we will, you know, be wearing our mask most of the time, and we will be trying to keep some social distancing.
Oh, and you feel safe doing that?
Yeah, I feel safe. But again, you know, we're not going to be hanging out with a lot of people. We're going to hang out with her and her husband, who have also been mostly indoors and who hopefully will be negative. You know, I definitely would not feel comfortable if all of a sudden a lot of her friends come to visit, right?
Dr. Carlos Del Rio, professor of global health and epidemiology at Emory University in Atlanta, with some thoughts about what everybody's thinking about, what to do during Thanksgiving. Doctor, thank you.
Delighted to talk to you, Robin.
This past weekend at a rally, President Trump mocked Joe Biden.
He'll listen to the scientists. If I listened totally to the scientists, we would right now have a country that would be in a massive depression instead of... We're like a rocket ship. Take a look at the numbers.
Trump's fans loved it. Other Americans may have wondered why. And why are they so angry? Well, Michael Sandel thinks he has at least part of the answer. He's the rock star poli-sci philosophy professor at Harvard. He says in addition to jobs that have moved overseas due to globalization or huge disparities in income, there's another inequity, the huge number of Americans who haven't attended a four-year school. As Professor Sandel put it in an op-ed, disdain for the less educated is the last acceptable prejudice. And he says to bridge this gap, we have to re-examine the notion in our meritocracy that if you work hard enough, you can make it. And he says if you did, there's a good chance you had help. Michael Sandel's book is The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good. It's fascinating. He joins us now. Welcome.
Good to be with you, Robin.
And, you know, I can just hear the voices saying, and maybe you don't mind saying a little bit too, if we're honest. Wait a minute. I worked for everything I have. Briefly, just remind us, Donald Trump, for instance, inherited $200 million from his father. Is that kind of part of what you mean?
It is, Robin. There is a tendency to believe that our success is our own doing. But this leads us to forget luck, family, teachers, coaches, what I call meritocratic hubris. And it goes along with the tendency to look down on those less fortunate or less credentialed than ourselves.
Okay, I'm sure there are listeners who really, really, really did pull them up by their own bootstraps single-handedly. And we want to acknowledge that, too. But you take us through where this noble idea of a meritocracy came from, the founding fathers wanting to move from an aristocracy, inherited power, to one based on merit, meritocracy. But then... You also explain how morality soon enters the picture. The Bible, in part, says, if you make it, you're blessed. If you don't, well, you get a plague.
Right. And that brings out the dark side of meritocracy. It's certainly inspiring to tell people you can make it if you try. But the implication is those who struggle, it must be their fault.
In a funny way, you write the English might have had it easier because... They knew they were in an aristocracy. The power is just going to be handed down to sons, likely, and daughters. And so they didn't blame themselves. Here, it becomes internalized. And here are some of the stats. It's easier to rise from poverty in Germany, Denmark, Canada than the U.S. Americans now born poor tend to stay poor. And so let's go to one of the reasons you say this is happening. The cousin of if you work hard, you will succeed is... If you don't go to a four-year college, you can't succeed. You remind us SATs were created by the then head of Harvard to get more qualified students from the Midwest who were not in this sort of blue blood stream that had been feeding Ivy League schools. But right. You say that it just doesn't work because schools have little impact on upward mobility. Most of the students there are well off in the first place.
Right. Today, there is a very close correlation between the income of your family and the likelihood of how well you will score. And despite generous financial aid, still it's the case that in Ivy League universities, there are more students from the top 1% than there are from the entire bottom half of the country. And even if somehow we could create a truly level playing field, there would still be a flaw in the meritocratic ideal, and this has to do with the attitudes toward winning and losing that accompanies a meritocratic society. Those attitudes, I think, have deepened the resentments that have come along with the inequality of income and wealth that we've seen in recent decades. It isn't just that working people have faced stagnant wages and job losses. It's also that those who've landed on top have come to believe that their success is their own doing, that those left behind must deserve their fate as well. And this sense of being looked down upon, a sense of humiliation, I think, is a big part of what enables politicians like Trump to succeed.
Well, let's stay with college for a second, because there's a sort of an arms race going on, which is one of the reasons that the people with more money have more kids in these schools, because they're probably getting SAT tutors or sending their kids abroad right in the summer to beef up their resume by having them work on some goodwill mission. I mean, if the current college scene is ungenerous to losers, those who are left out, it's also oppressive to winners. It's making these kids nervous wrecks. In other words, merit has become a tyrant. So you have suggestions, yours and others, and you start with colleges. You say, how about you just have to have a certain level of grades? Then from that group, choose who actually goes to school according to a lottery.
Right. A lottery of the qualified. Places like Harvard and Stanford get over 40,000 applicants each year for about 2,000 places. Run a lottery. What I'm hoping to prompt is a greater recognition of the role of luck. We've turned those adolescent years into a kind of stress-strewn meritocratic gauntlet. By the time they arrive in college, they're shell-shocked, so the tyranny of merit exerts its oppressive character toward those who are excluded and who are denied dignity and esteem in the society, not to say well-paying jobs as well. But it also oppresses even the winners.
The lottery would help some climb up a rung toward college, but not everybody wants to. And this brings us to, instead of making success conditioned on rising up that ladder, which implies fleeing where you are, improve, and also respect where people are. You mentioned a Republican strategist, Owen Cass. He says Republicans should not push corporate tax cuts and free trade to boost the GDP. Focus instead on workers, including a government wage subsidy for low-income workers.
Renew the dignity of work and put the question of the dignity of work right at the center of our political debate. We've focused too single-mindedly on addressing the deepening inequality by saying, go to college, what you earn will depend on what you learn, you can make it if you try. And I argue that this is an inadequate response. What we should be doing instead is focusing less on arming people for meritocratic competition and focus more on the dignity of work. But I also think the dignity of work is more than merely economic. It has to do with according respect and recognition and social esteem. So what I'm calling for really, Robin, is a shift away from seeing individual upward mobility as the only solution to inequality, and instead trying to make life better for those who don't have a four-year college degree, and nearly two-thirds of Americans do not.
And that's
yet,
amazing.
Two-thirds.
Yeah.
We forget this. And yet, we woefully underinvest in the forms of learning on which the majority of our fellow citizens depend: state colleges, two-year community colleges, and vocational and technical training. We don't accord these forms of learning the honor and respect that they are due and that they have in other countries such as Germany.
It's kind of funny, your main point, restoring the dignity of work, because we're doing that at least in the short term now. Suddenly, making some of our most low-paid workers heroes, you know, orderlies in hospitals and cashiers. We know we can do it, but as far as actually making change, you know we've been here before. You give props to Michael Young's 1958 book, The Rise of Meritocracy. You know, he thought it was great that class barriers were being broken, that children of the working class could rise. But he predicted hubris and humiliation would be inevitable. It would set up a false value system, mistaking achievement for human worth. So how else make this change? I mean, Donald Trump never says, you can make it if you try, which was President Obama's rallying cry. Donald Trump never says that. He uses the language of grievance. He says there's winners and losers, and they think you're losers. Should Democrats stop saying you can make it in America if you just work hard?
I think Democrats and Republicans have made the mistake of assuming that the rhetoric of rising, the idea that you can make it if you try, is an adequate response. The rhetoric of rising is not enough. And what these mainstream politicians and parties missed was the insult implicit in this meritocratic offer of mobility. It was highly conditional. If you get a four-year college degree, then you will have a chance to rise. I think that Democrats have had a kind of tin ear to the anger, to the frustration, to the resentments that have been building. Donald Trump proved adept at tapping into that sense of grievance. And I think we also need to remind those on top of the role of luck and good fortune. Recognizing the role of luck can prompt a certain humility, and humility is the civic virtue we need now.
And just to underscore that, you're not saying get rid of excellence. We all want to go to the best doctors or have the best plumber. If you are one of those with a combination of luck and hard work who's made it, a little dollop of there but for the grace of God go I towards someone who hasn't will go a long way.
It will.
Michael Sandel, professor of poli-sci and philosophy at Harvard. His book is The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. STM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Wednesday, October 21st from 7 to 8 p.m. stm.mit.edu.
A federal judge has struck down a Trump administration rule that would have eliminated food stamps for nearly 700,000 Americans. In her ruling on Sunday, the district court judge in Washington, D.C., called the Trump policy arbitrary and capricious, especially during a pandemic that has caused demand for food stamps to rise 17% since the outbreak began. Ed Bolin is a senior policy analyst at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. It's a nonprofit that looks at how budget policies affect low-income households. Ed, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
And so it sounds like SNAP benefits, which is another way of saying food stamps, are safe for the time being, but remind us what the Trump administration was trying to do here.
Sure. So the Trump administration had proposed a rule that would have made it much harder for unemployed workers who don't have kids in their homes to get food stamps or SNAP. The administration did it by restricting benefits in areas where people could still have trouble finding a job or getting to work. So states couldn't continue to provide benefits after a couple of months, even if somebody was looking for work or working part-time.
Hmm. Well, a fair number of people, you know, do believe that if someone is an able-bodied adult, no dependents or no children, like there should be more restrictions on getting food stamps. But obviously, the situation is very different now because of the pandemic. Unemployment is up four times what it was last year when the policy was first rolled out by the Trump administration. But even like pre-pandemic, weren't critics saying that this whole idea was short-sighted anyway?
Absolutely. It is interesting. The pandemic, I think, shines a light on why states needed to be able to continue to allow folks to get SNAP if they were low income enough to qualify for it, precisely because unemployment hits people and communities in different ways. We saw in the pandemic that mostly low-wage workers were the ones that lost most of the jobs. Those jobs aren't coming back in many industries, like the restaurant industry, janitors, home health aides. All these folks are folks that typically can rely on SNAP even while they're working, but certainly when they're in between jobs. So that always existed. Pre-pandemic, those same communities and those same individuals might have job for a couple of months and then need some SNAP. Many of them would be working and getting SNAP at the same time. So the rule, we thought, was arbitrary, capricious, and harmful to low-wage workers who are in and out of jobs pre-pandemic and especially post-pandemic or during the pandemic.
Yeah. And by the way, we've done a lot of reporting on how food banks around the country are feeling a lot of pressure because so many people have lost their jobs in the pandemic. How much strain has it put on the food stamp system, on the SNAP system?
Well, there has been a strain on SNAP as well. Agencies, state agencies that operate the program have been swamped, although, you know, it will vary. Some states got hit harder than other states, but almost every single state saw some kind of an increase. We estimate 6 million, probably more at this point, folks have had to turn to SNAP. But the good thing about SNAP is that if you can make it through an eligibility system, and that has been a struggle during the pandemic, partly because a lot of SNAP offices are closed and agencies are using old technology and everybody's trying to do things remotely. But if you can get on, then you get a benefit card and you can use it at a store, a grocery store, Walmart. So it's very efficient and it helps, I think, relieve the strain on food banks and community groups that have been struggling to also meet the needs of people who have lost their jobs and their incomes.
Yeah. That's Ed Boland, Senior Policy Analyst at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Ed, thanks for your insight. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Texas has seen a surge of early voting, which started in that state last week. Democrats there are trying to take control of the state House of Representatives, and that would be a big deal because Republicans have held all three branches of state government in Texas for nearly 20 years. Ashley Lopez of KUT in Austin has been tracking this story for a series and podcast called The Big Flip. Ashley, welcome. It really would be a big flip, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would be a huge change. I don't think it's hyperbole to say Republicans basically control every lever of power on the state level. The governor, the state house, the state senate, you know, even things like land commissioner and attorney general, even just one lever sort of changing to another party would be a huge change.
That would be a big deal. And why do Democrats think that they could take the house this year? Is it demographics? Is it economics?
It's a little bit of both, but mostly demographics, right? Because Texas's economy, until recently, has been pretty steady. A lot of people have been moving here because a lot of tech jobs have moved here. Like, the economy has been pretty consistent. But I think, like, of course, nationally, the pandemic has changed all that. But, you know, the state has been getting more diverse racially. And more importantly, it's always been racially diverse, but more Black and Latino voters are actually casting ballots, and that was definitely true in 2018. And definitely younger people are voting in larger numbers. So these are groups of people who are more likely to vote for Democrats, you know, right now. And the suburbs have gotten more Democratic, and that usually was a place where Republicans could bank on some support. And that's been changing.
Well, there was a time when Democrats actually held power in Texas, and we have some sound here from your series. This is Tom Craddock, who was elected to the Texas House in 1968. By the way, he's still there today. But back then, he was just one of a handful of Republicans.
I remember I introduced my first bill to create a district court in Midland, and basically we're like, but Republicans don't introduce bills, you know, because there were so few of us.
So, Ashley, let's go back in history for just a minute here. What happened in Texas that originally gave Republicans this lock on power that you've described today?
Yeah, so, like, this isn't unique to Texas, but there was a big shift that happened in politics around that time, especially after LBJ's administration. There was, like, a generational resorting of politics, and that definitely changed politics in places like Texas and the South. And, you know, Republicans first won the governorship, and then, you know, years after that, it was the Senate. And then it wasn't until the early aughts, you know, 2002, that Republicans were able to take over the Texas House and have a lock on all three. But it just happened happened over time. You know, new strategies. They, you know, the Republicans started spending a lot of money and targeting rural parts of the state, and I mean that's still a big stronghold for them. So it just it happens slowly over time.
Yeah, but then in 2018, just 2 years ago, Beto O'Rourke, the Democrat, did a lot better than people thought he would in that Senate race, particularly in a handful of Republican districts. Andrew Regan with the Texas House Democratic Campaign told you why.
It's hard to really get your finger on the rapid change that's happening in these districts because it's both younger, more diverse, and it's more college-educated than the country as a whole. And we've seen that college-educated voters specifically have been repelled by both Trump and the Republican Party.
And actually, you've kind of hinted at this already, but was that Senate race 2 years ago kind of a prelude to what we're talking about now in this election?
Totally. And if nothing else, it was a trial balloon. It was a way to, like, for the Democrats to see, where is it that we have voters now in places where Republicans have been winning elections? And specifically, there are 9 districts that Beto O'Rourke won, that Republicans won the state house. And these are places where Democrats are kind of bullish because they see, like, there are people willing to vote for a majority of Democrats are willing to vote for a Democrat there. Now, Republicans would say this is because of Beto, like Beto is a unique thing that happened in Texas politics. Right. But Democrats say, no, this is about changing demographics. This is about something larger than Beto O'Rourke. And so that's why that election to them was something really interesting.
Well, in fact, here's Republican political consultant Luke Macias, who's talking about just that.
Republicans are going to hold on to the House because Texans do not want to move our state in the direction of the socialist policies that the Democrat Party has established as their platform moving forward.
So, yes, Texas has been a traditionally red state, but let's just say that Luke Macias is wrong and that Democrats do win the House. How does that change politics in the state of Texas?
Likely, just if, you know, Democrats take the House, just likely fewer things will happen. You know, I guess on the sort of less negative side of that, there would just be a discussion of things that maybe Republicans haven't wanted to talk about before. You know, Texas is one of the few states in the country that hasn't expanded Medicaid, for example. And then, of course, the big thing is redistricting because 2021 is a redistricting year.
Right. So Texas has already seen pretty big turnout in early voting already this year before Election Day. Does that offer any clues of what might happen?
No, I never, you know, it is like historically, like early voting doesn't tell you much about outcomes. I mean, if you were to just look at early voting in 2018, you would have thought Beto O'Rourke was going to win. But Election Day votes are so massive that you never know what's going to happen, especially during a pandemic. But historically speaking, like early voting doesn't tell you enough. It does show, however, that Democrats are energized and more mobilized than they've been in a long time. And I think you could have told you, people could have told you that before people started heading to the polls for early voting.
Well, we're going to find out soon, aren't we? Ashley Lopez, reporter for KUT in Austin. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's go now to Granville County in North Carolina, a swing county and a swing state that could be crucial to the winner of the presidential race. Granville County, outside the city of Durham, went for Barack Obama in 2012 and then flipped to President Trump 4 years ago. North Carolina Public Radio's Rusty Jacobs has been to Granville County several times to speak with voters, and he has our story.
I met Linda Smart a couple of weeks ago as she was taking an afternoon walk in a Granville park with her husband, Henry. It was just before the first presidential debate. Smart is a 66-year-old registered Republican who describes herself as a one-time liberal. Her husband retired from the Air Force, and she says she trusts Trump to support the military and defend law enforcement. And that support hasn't faded, even after a presidential debate she described as terrible.
They were both just antagonizing each other and saying, they don't tell you what they're going to do. They tell you what the other person isn't going to do or what he lied about doing.
Smart even confessed to thinking former Vice President Joe Biden had a more presidential manner than Trump.
I feel bad saying that because I want dignity for the country. I want respect. I want everything else. But most of all, I just don't want to go socialist.
I caught up with 64-year-old David Quinn at his historic home near downtown Oxford. Quinn's a registered unaffiliated voter and, like Linda Smart, was disgusted by the debate. But Quinn says he's sticking with President Trump anyway.
You know, do I like Trump person? Not really. Do I like what Trump is doing from a policy perspective? Yes.
Quinn isn't even moved by a New York Times expose that reported the wealthy president's federal income tax bill was only $750 the year he took office.
I would expect anybody on that level of operation to be leveraging the tax code every which way they can.
Granville County has a little more than 38,000 registered voters, with a solid mix of registered Democrats, Republicans, and unaffiliated voters. Meredith College political science professor David McLennan describes Granville as a quintessential ex-urban battleground, caught smack dab in the middle of the red conservative countryside and the blue urban areas of the Research Triangle.
In reality, the voting patterns indicate that it's almost a 50-50 county.
Creedmoor is where I first found Walty Blackwell, cutting the hair of a tow-headed teen at the Major League Barbershop.
Okay.
Blackwell's a 41-year-old registered Democrat and a black, single working mother of three. She's trying to make ends meet while helping her kids with remote learning during the COVID-19 pandemic. When I first spoke with her, Blackwell said she believes President Trump's divisive rhetoric has made the country more hostile, and she fears for her children.
I just want them to grow up in a better world where they don't have to be afraid where they go or how they look.
But still, Blackwell insisted she had not made up her mind about the presidential race. But that was before the first debate. Now she says that contentious affair told her everything she needed to know about the current president.
I was just floored. I just was like, you know, no way in hell I'm voting for him.
Blackwell says she's convinced the Democratic ticket would better protect access to affordable health care and the interests of working class people like her. Still, it's hard to tell whether that view will prevail in a county that went for Donald Trump by just 2.5 percentage points 4 years ago. For Here and Now, I'm Rusty Jacobs.
We've been hearing a certain theme to start this week. The number of new cases of COVID-19 is rising dramatically, up by nearly a third in recent weeks, according to the New York Times. Public health experts are warning of a new surge. And Derek Thompson has some thoughts on how we can stop it. In fact, his headline is, "The COVID-19 Fall Surge is Here. We Can Stop It." Derek Thompson is staff writer at The Atlantic. He joins us from Washington, as he does every Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hey, how's it going?
Well, according to you, hopefully, you know, that's something we need to hear. We can stop it. And people listening, it's maybe as simple as opening a door and a window on opposite sides of a classroom. We're going to get to that. But Derek, before that, you know, these numbers are grim. Where do you get this notion that this surge can be stopped?
Well, two large buckets, I would say. The first is on the therapeutic side. We're just doing a lot better in terms of treating this disease when people show up at the hospital. Mortality rates contingent on hospitalization have declined by a lot in Europe, in the U.S. This is still a dangerous disease, but it is not nearly as fatal as it was in March or April, when you had all these scientists and doctors who didn't understand what was a novel, and still is a novel, coronavirus. That's number one. Number two is, even on the non-medical side, we're learning a lot about, you know, how to act, understanding that there's mm-hmm. a pandemic. The mm-hmm. evidence around the efficacy of masks has really increased. The evidence around the danger of crowded indoors has become impossible to ignore. And so not only are people working in big pharma smarter about this, doctors are smarter about this, but so are we. And so if we simply look at the evidence from around the world, I think that we have a chance to stop a clear fall surge from becoming a winter catastrophe.
So you say Americans need to embrace empiricism. This is science, people. You know, what is laid out right in front of us, but also imperfection, because right now there's no silver bullet, but there might be a whole bunch of bronze bullets, as you put it. And to do that, to understand that better, let's look at South Korea, for instance, which has managed to avoid large-scale lockdowns and stay-at-home orders and gone with more masks, more tracing.
Yeah, I think people looking at the South Korean example, which has really been an extraordinary success story in terms of their response to COVID, sometimes assume that South Korea must have locked everything down like China did and like some countries in Europe did. They did not. People who I talked to in Seoul in April said they were never on lockdown. Instead, the country focused on places like bars and nightclubs where crowding was essentially inevitable. Instead, they focused on universal mask wearing, and they they also focused on making sure that places that might inevitably lead to indoor crowding would essentially be shut down and maybe even bailed out. They also had really impressive test and trace protocols to essentially backtrace large super spreading events to figure out exactly how they happened and get everybody to isolate as fast as possible. They simply had a much more organized, much more empirical, top-down governmental strategy to take this on than the U.S., where it's been a little bit more federalized, a little more ad hoc, and certainly a lot more scattershot at the federal level.
Well, and they paid attention to the science. There's a new research that estimates that when an infected person and a non-infected person both wear masks, it can reduce the chance of transmission to the non-infected person by up to 80%. So in other words, they can get that non-infected person wearing a mask won't be as sick, you know, because they won't get infected as much if they do get infected. And so they're paying attention to mm-hmm. that. Let's move over to Vietnam, where you write, you know, Vietnam posted a fine for people who posted fake or distorted information on social media. They had a song that everybody could sing, Jealous Coronavirus. What else did they do?
Well, what I think is so interesting about Vietnam, this is a country that is right next door to China and has so far, in a nation of 95 million people, announced an official COVID-19 death count of 35. 35. Mm. That's roughly the number of Americans dying of this disease every hour and a half. So even if you, let's say you don't believe the 35 number because you think they're futzing with their numbers, well, they've returned to normal life throughout many parts of Vietnam much faster than we've returned to so-called normal life in America. And that's in large part because the government has been extremely, exquisitely clear with citizens about the threat of this outbreak. Since January, you have had a very clear message from the government saying wear masks, socially distance, wash your hands. They have texted people's phones. They have created these viral videos and viral songs, like the one that you mentioned on the Jealous Coronavirus. There's just been a very clear and organized message, again, from the top that says this is the disease that we're facing, and here are some bronze bullets, empirical but imperfect ways that we can all fight it together.
I just want to mention Japan quickly because they also did masks and tracing, but now they're getting kids back to school with things like plastic dividers that slow down the spread of these droplets and opening doors and windows on the opposite sides. I mean, there are simple things in the few seconds we've had.
Masks, social distance, ventilation. Again, these are not silver bullets. They are bronze bullets. They are empirical, but they're imperfect. But all together, you know, five bronze bullets can be almost the equivalent of one silver bullet.
Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic, giving us so much hope and practicality. Derek, thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to open all the doors and windows. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.